take a minute to
say something about what I want to try and do in this last piece of the series. I want to spend the first... My hope is about 45 minutes, but I may be wrong about this. Kind of doing a conclusion to last week's discussion of walking in God's ways and the life of Chesed. I want to do that by looking at a few, I think, interesting sources that I want to make sure you're aware of, have thought about, etc. That's going to be sort of the main goal for the first part, 45 minutes, an hour maximum. And then I want to try a little bit of an experiment, which I hope that later on you will give me some feedback about. We're going to try to do a little bit of a spiritual chavruta time. And the reason we're going to do that is that we have spent a lot of time talking about some pretty basic ideas. The ideas that I suggested at the beginning were the heart of Judaism, tarte mashma, right? That is both the core and the stuff that is supposed to speak not only to our minds but also to our hearts. And sometimes I get nervous that Jews in general are good at talking about ideas, and some Jews are good at talking about ideas, about getting beyond ideas. And with that in mind, I actually want to spend some time pushing us a little bit to return to some of the themes that we've talked about over the last 7 weeks and think about personalizing them. And basically, I'll explain a little more about that when we get there. Guests are totally welcome to participate, but are also should not feel captive when we do that. Okay, so I'm going to hand out a little packet, which is not so little, but I'm going to send them around. Actually, with me. They're not quite enough. There are more in the printer, but it was taking a long time. I want to begin by just sharing with you a brief passage from Rabbi Simcha Zissel Ziv Broida, who we looked at in the first or second session. Simcha Zissel Ziv was one of the three great figures of the Musar movement in Eastern Europe. Of the Musar movement, Nuat HaMusar. And if you turn in your packet to this one, I apologize, is not in English, this one passage. To the first page after the typed stuff, which says Chochmah Musar. His book of sermons is called Chochmah Musar. It should look like a PDF, not like a page that I typed. God bless whoever created HebrewBooks.org. If you haven't spent time on that website, you should, you know, it'll change your life if you're into learning Sfarim. So I sort of wanted to show you this because I think it's really interesting, and I don't know enough yet about the range of Musar texts, but I think it's fairly predominant in that worldview. There is a move away from the notion of cleaving to God as some kind of ecstatic experience and towards cleaving to God as a function of cleaving to... That's not the right one.
Sorry.
Cleaving to God's attributes. I do not have any more of that. If you want to run downstairs and take them out of the Xerox machine, there's a couple more packets.
Okay.
Okay, sorry. So the move is away from focusing on, oh, I just had the most amazing davening in the world and, you know, my boundaries were obliterated and I was one with God, whatever that could possibly mean, right? And towards the sense of I was united with God in attaching myself to God's compassion. We saw that. Actually, no, let me stop there and let's actually read this together, okay? So, This is where it says, "Yudalid v'halachta b'drachav." You should walk in God's ways. Ohev shalom. And we're not going to. We're not going to read this whole long drasha. I just really wanted to look at two paragraphs together I think were interesting. I'll ask somebody to read, and then we'll translate. So people who are having trouble with the Hebrew, we should be able to keep you right along the process here. Ellie, would you be willing to? Do you mind? Okay. So this is a letter. You can see that from the fact that it says, Lichvod Yedidi. This is, by the way, a great... you could read this as ironic, but it's not. Lichvod Yedidi Harav HaGaon V'chule. Right? I mean, right? To my friend, the rabbi, the genius, etc. Now, I assume the V'chule is that we're not talking about who the actual person is, but it may also be an allusion to the way, you know, Militza... Right, you know what Militza is, right? When you kind of begin... Well, okay, Militza is schmaltzy language. But in particular, right, rabbis traditionally, when they begin letters to each other, often pepper each other with a barrage of great, you know, praise. So, it has occurred to me, by the way, sometime, although I can't really justify this pedagogically, to have an ongoing shiur where we just read the front page of Svarim, and the way that different rabbis in different periods are described, right? And sort of how that, how what that might say about how we imagine what a rabbi is. The best people at this are Hasidim, right? If you look at the front page of many Hasidic Svarim, you would think that everyone who ever wrote a Sefer was just short of God. Okay, go ahead. That can't go on the web. Yeah, go ahead.
Amar Moreno Varavenu.
Adoni Avi Mori V'Rabi. Okay, this is a common phrase, especially in later rabbinic literature. My father, my master. Actually, Adoni Avi. My master, my father, my teacher, and rabbi. Haya.
Haya Ish Shalom, Ohev Shalom, Rodev Shalom.
So, right, my father was a man of peace. He loved peace, and he pursued it. That's an allusion to what? Pirkei Avot's description of Aharon, the Midah of Aharon, Moshe's brother. Aharon was a Rodev Shalom. Aharon was the person who sought compromise, sought conciliation. Okay?
Yishlach le'Hashem Yitbarach, Ezrato Mikudash Leilech.
Mikodesh, Ezrato Mikodesh.
Mikodesh, Leilech Bazeh Haderech, Kol Yemei Chayai.
Okay, so may God, right, send me help from up high to walk in this way of my father all the days of my life. May I be a man of peace. Okay? Ve'azeda.
Ve'azeda, kama mutzlach ani, ki ein hatzlacha yoter gedola mizeh.
Okay, here it's important that you not, you know, read hatzlacha here in the sort of like conventional Western notion of success. Right? Ve'azeda, and then I will know how... And I'm open to suggestions how we might render a mutzlach here. How successful I have been at becoming a human being. How much I have achieved spiritually. How far... None of this is good. I'm a little bit tempted to invoke this is not going to help anyone. The Greek word eudaimonia, right? The notion of like a person who has achieved the good life. How have I done in the process of becoming... a real person. Okay? Ki ein hatzlacha yoter gedola mizeh. There is no greater human achievement, says Rav Simcha Zissel Ziv, than being a man of peace, a person of peace. Okay? Go ahead.
Misha amal hiyot kua bo ahavat habriyot ki hatzlacha hayoter gedola le'adam be'olamo hi lehiyot
mekorav
l'Hashem itbarach.
We'll translate in a minute, okay. Okay, so now let's just sort of translate this. Misha amel liyot tku'a bo avat habriyot. I like this image. right? Someone who works hard, labors to have the love of other humans, kuabo, say implanted in him or her, right? Someone who really works on internalizing the love of others, that is, actually, it's not a great Hebrew sentence, right? That's his description. And then he says, right, because the greatest success, achievement, right, the greatest level a human being can achieve is to be close to God, right? As it says, V'ani kirvat Elohim litov, I know that what is good for me is closeness to God. And he says, V'einan lishtokek ma, there is nothing to yearn for but closeness to God, because that is the essence of the good. And one who is close to God, in the process of becoming close to God, is close to every good. And who wouldn't want that? Right? That's the kind of the setup he's doing here. Now again, in a certain kind of Jewish text, you might expect that the next paragraph will be, at least of this, from this last second half of this paragraph, is, therefore I'm into ecstatic prayer. Right? Therefore I seek out, you know, the experiential above all else, because the closest I can come to God is through experience. But he's going to take this in a totally different direction, as I already mentioned. Go ahead, Eli.
V'hinei midat HaKadosh Baruch Hu shehu ohev lachol, ki im lo ken lo haya lahem kiyum ba'olam.
Okay, stop there for a second. He says, what do we know about God? The aspect of God is that God is, God loves all, because if God didn't, they wouldn't exist. Right? By the way, this is, I think, a corollary of what I talked about the very first session in the Rambam. Meaning, God doesn't owe me life, so if God doesn't owe me life, then why else would God have brought me into life other than out of love and desire to bestow kindness? Right? So this is all connected to the notion of chesed in the Rambam sense of grace, right? Okay, now go ahead. Ki ahavat habriot. Okay, this sentence I think is sort of the linchpin of his whole project, right? So what do we see? That love of human beings is closeness to God. What does karutz mechomer mean? Yeah, okay, so we probably would say flesh and blood, right? Ki ech yachol karutz mechomer?
Lihyot karov ve'lav yitbarach.
Right, because after all, you can't be earthly, mortal, and actually be close in some physical or ontological way to the God who is totally transcendent. So what can you be close to?
Malachei mala shoalim ze laze ayei mekom kivodo. Aval chazal v'kedushatam hodiyo lanu v'ma yitkarev ha'adam elav yitbarach yidabek b'midotav v'chule.
This is like a great rhetorical move, right? He says the angels ask each other, where is the place of God's glory? Meaning even the angels don't have access to God as God is, right? And yet he says, but Chazal told us how to be close to God. Mahu rachum afata, mahu chanun afata, right? Just as God is merciful, so should you be. Just as God is kind, so should you be. That, those words are not here, but that's what it means, right? Kidabek b'midotav, right? Cleave to God's attributes. Now, I wanted to show you this because, first of all, I think this is a playing out of stuff that is pretty central to rabbinic and many medieval Jewish sources. But it's also a little bit of an interesting critique of an excessive preoccupation with religious experience, which I think a lot of Jewish sources, certainly not all, a lot of them are nervous about the possibility of being preoccupied with experience as potentially a kind of narcissistic undertaking, right? Oh, so what's the meaning of my religious life? I feel amazing after shul. And there's something kind of maybe problematic about that. Or let me put it differently, maybe inadequate about that. Right? Putting that at the very center of one's kind of spiritual radar is problematic. And here it's sort of a reminder about loving God not only translates to, but authentic love of God necessarily is constituted, at least partly, by, right, one's relationship to other humans. Okay, any thoughts or questions or clarifications about this? Anybody want to help say what I just said more clearly, if it wasn't clear? No one has anything to say. That's great. So maybe we'll get to the Chavruta part sooner.
Can I clarify a question?
Yes.
Is he's pro-experience or not pro-experience?
Well, you know, if you ask the question, is someone pro-experience or not pro-experience, based on this text, I would say he's agnostic, meaning I think he's anti-putting experientialism at the very heart of one's religious life, meaning he's pro-love much sooner than he's pro-experience.
Love is not experience.
Great. So, fair enough. I am using a kind of shorthand for experience being what happens inside me, or if you want to be more generous, what happens between me and God alone for a moment. It's not, when people tend to talk about experience, they're not primarily talking about the experience of learning to love others more deeply. Everything is an experience at that. I mean, right? That's a fair critique. But the notion is religious life is not about what happens to me in my solitude. Does that make sense to you? I mean, by the way, my answer to Ross, I mean, seriously, I don't know this text well enough to know whether he is suspicious of experience or skeptical of the unique privileging of experience. Those are two very different things. Right? You can be in favor of, yes, I would like davening to be transformative in some way. In fact, ideally I want to have a kind of relationship to God and tefillah where my experience of tefillah and the experience of Ahavat HaBriyot are interwoven in some way. But I think he wants to sort of point us to, right, keep our eyes on the spiritual prize. Right, and the prize, as he puts it, is being an Ohev Shalom, which is about how I manifest my Avodat Hashem, my worship of God, in the interpersonal sphere. And at the risk of saying something that I spend my whole life running around saying, right, this does not mean reducing God to the ethical. Right, it means that the most central consequence of a relationship with God is in the ethical. Those two things are very different. Right? Let's take an example from Catholic theology. Right? You know, it's a very common statement in the history of the church, the statement, God is love, which the origins of which are inherently Trinitarian. That is, right, that sentence is about the different parts of God are in relation all the time. That's why Jews don't traditionally use the formulation God is love. But as critics of liberal Christian theology like to say, the fact that God is love does not mean that love is God. Right? Does not mean that love is God. Is that, people understand what I just said? Okay.
Quick question. So God is love in that understanding, the Christian understanding, it's somehow related to the Trinity while being in relation one to the other.
Exactly.
And that's what it's expressing.
Mm-hmm. That's its origin. I mean, I'm sure, I don't know if everyone who uses that phrase means it that way, but its origin is there. Okay. Anything else? Yeah.
I don't understand what you mean by that. The fact that God is love is not that love is God. Because it seems like what you're saying, that it's ultimately in human relationship that God is manifest.
One's worship of God, right, manifests in the interpersonal sphere, but God does not equal the interpersonal sphere. The language of manifest is very important, meaning one's relationship with God is manifest, is revealed, is played out in the interpersonal sphere, but the interpersonal sphere is not God. There's still a transcendent God who we're talking about. That's the argument of all of these traditionally oriented texts. Right? Does that... In other words... Let's give the best Jewish example of this, right? Harold Schulweis, right, is the best example of a contemporary Jewish writer who basically makes the move of, oh, love is God. What is God? Bikur Cholim is God. Nichum Avelim is God, right? Comforting the mourners, visiting the sick. Okay, I'm not sure why you call it God at that point, but the point of rabbinic sources and this text is those things are not God, they are consequences of a relationship with God. They are manifest, maybe you'll even say they're manifestations of God's presence in the world. But that's not the same thing as saying that they're God.
Also, God is not limited to that. Right?
Yes, no, for sure.
That's like implied in that scene.
I don't even think it's implied. I think it's...
Okay.
It's more, yeah, you're right, it is implied. He doesn't make it explicit. It's on the boundary of implicit and explicit. Right? I mean, he comes close to that by saying, right, what else could we possibly know of God? So it suggests that there is, God is not that without remainder. Right? Okay. So, I just... You all right there, Vicky? Okay.
No, I'm sorry. I was just playing with
my dad. I just wanted to... I don't really know exactly what I want us to do with this, but I want to draw your attention to something, because I don't feel like one can talk about compassion in Jewish sources without at least reminding oneself of Parashat Mishpatim, known to Bible scholars right as the Covenant Code, one of the three central law codes in the Chumash, Sefer HaBrit. And what is really striking about these two laws in Sefer HaBrit is here you have a law code that is basically a laying out of a series of laws. Don't do this, do this. In the case of this, you should do that, etc. And here you have these sort of totally unlegalese explosions in the midst of a law code. So I want to just actually read them and then ask you, I don't know what the answer is. I may have ideas about this, but I want to ask you what this is doing here. Okay? So, Exodus 22... I guess just in the interest of time, we can read this in English, and people can follow along in both. Rachie, would you be willing to read? This is just source 2 on the front page of the packet, sorry.
You shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If thou afflict them in any wise, for if they cry at all unto me, I will surely hear their cry. My wrath shall wax hot, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless.
Okay, this is like, we could actually spend a lot of time on this, which we won't. This is an interesting example of sort of the relationship in some biblical texts between God's compassion and God's rage. That's not the main thing I want to talk about here. I'm more interested in verse 24 and what follows. Go ahead.
If thou lend money to any of my people, even to the poor with thee, thou shalt not be to him as a creditor, neither shall he lay upon him interest. If thou at all take thy neighbor's garments to pledge, thou shalt restore it unto him by that the sun goeth down. For that is his only covering, it is his garment for his skin. Wherein shall he sleep? And it shall come to pass, when he crieth unto me, that I will hear, for I am gracious.
Okay, so one of the problems of using the old JPS translation is that, for us, these words seem so far away. And verse 26, let's just render it colloquially for a second, right? It's the only thing he has to wear. It's literally the only thing that covers his skin. What's he going to sleep in? When he cries out to me, I'll hear, because I am all merciful. And the thing that, you know, I remember the first time I think I ever learned Parashat Mishpatim, I was so struck by this. You know, if you open up Parashat Mishpatim and keep reading it, it's it reads like a law code. And then comes this Bamei Yishan. What's he going to sleep in? It's the most unlegalese formulation in a legal context that I've ever seen. It's like so dramatic. And I wanted to ask what we make of that. What is that doing here? What is the effect of having this sort of prolonged passage in legalese and then this sort of like outburst? What do you have to say about that?
I guess if you sort of start with all of these commandments, then you're sort of already like in that mindset, and it's kind of impossible to come up with like very, very set ways of making sure that people see these like more interpersonal things as commandments, then maybe by just ordering it with other things, that sense of commandedness comes through to the parts that seem like a little less, less practically applied. Or like, you can say you're gonna, I'm thinking more about Mishpatim in terms of less, like more so in the sense that you have all of these different practical ideas, like different ways that you deal with slaves and your oxes and all of these different things, and then you have a lot of these things come after it, like the things like how you treat people well, and maybe that's more of the thinking than this coming after 21 or 23. So that may not be so relevant.
Interesting to think about that a little bit. Yeah, Ilana, you want to say something?
I just think that when reading law codes, the tendency is to get very legalistic, and I think this is I think it's very easy for people reading law codes to kind of snap into a different mindset or a different way of thinking, and I think this is like a smack to get you back to actual human relation, which is an obvious thing to say, but I think that I think it's saying like this isn't only law, this is real. Okay, so preoccupied with parsing every word of this and figuring out the loopholes and figuring out how to analyze it that you would ever forget that people are, real humans who are really golden.
So, it's interesting because I think if we took what you said one step further, it seems like this law code is doing one step more, right? It's certainly, I think, doing what you're saying, but as you were saying it, I was thinking, yeah, but it also Dafka builds, it doesn't say the two options. Okay, here's a law code, and then I say, oh, we're doing law. By the way, don't forget about other people. Right? Don't forget that law affects real humans. Here, I think it goes one step further, and it actually builds that second impulse into the law itself. Right? Meaning, do people understand the difference between the two things I just said? Right? I can make you a list of laws, and then I can say, oh, by the way, Lifni Mishurat Hadin, right? Go beyond the letter of the law based on the reality of human beings, right? Here, by the way, whether Lifni Mishurat Hadin is actually not required by the law is in itself an interesting question. But, okay, that's one possibility. This does something else really interesting, which is it says that impulse of remember we're talking about human beings is not something that is beyond the law. It is itself codified into the law. I think something like really dramatic about that. Of course, you also have statements in the Bavli that cut in the other direction, right? Things like Ein Merachamin Badin, right? That we apply the law, as the law. So I don't know. I mean, but I think that the impulse of this text, anyway, is really striking in that way. Other people want to say, Alex, please.
Yeah, I like that reading. I guess what bugs me about it is that I want to see that more often. Like how come that sort of statement doesn't break through all of the laws? Like, I feel like, there must be something that, meaningful in each of the other laws to come in and come in, or else it's enough, but it doesn't always say that.
Well, right, it doesn't always say it, but I would say two things about that. One is, the number of times that the Torah appeals to your own experience of suffering is vast, right? It's vast, right? The number of times the Torah says, because you were a slave, or because you were a stranger, it's actually not a small amount. And by the way, this Second thing, I don't mean as apologetic, because I'm not only apologetics, I'm not even sure I agree with it, but I want to suggest a possibility that maybe the power of doing something like this depends on not doing it every 2 minutes. Meaning, if the American law code, I don't know, am I right about this? I'm not sure. But, you know, if every law was followed by, after all, would anyone read it anymore, or would it be, in other words, is the jarring effect precisely what gives it its power? I don't know. I mean, that's genuinely a question. That is not a rhetorical question. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I guess my question with that would be, like, I think my nature, and I don't know if it's our nature, but Stephanie's mind is to read this as, like, a justification of all law, whereas should we, not justification, there's, like, a attachment to all law. Should we read it as an attachment specifically to this law, because this is where it appears?
Yeah. I want to say yes to both, meaning on the one hand, right, the Torah does seem to want to apply this specifically to the person who's been reduced to the rawest form of poverty, right, that there's a kind of extra impulse to push us to compassion towards that person. But on the other hand, right, if I've been trying to say anything in all these weeks, is that the thrust of Torah more broadly is to make us into a certain kind of human being. Right, and so the impulse that would lead us to care about the person in rawest poverty is the kind of impulse that should lead us to care, period. But that said, I don't think it's insignificant that they choose, say, it here. Right, so it's kind of like a little bit of a dance we'd have to do. Yeah, Ross.
It's sort of interesting that the law is speaking to the person that's lending out money. And I think, like, isn't there, like, a really, like, importantly Christian theology that looks at the inverse of the same statement? It says, like, if you are someone who's, like, receiving a loan and they come and take your clothes and that's, like, all you have, then you give that up also. And they kind of use that as a way of kind of flipping, sort of, like, what the statement is, who the statement is addressing.
That's in that context. The shirt off your back is in that context. I thought that was actually about someone who's in need being willing to give them absolutely anything you have. Am I misremembering that? Okay, that's interesting. I have to think about that more. It's a really interesting association, and I honestly just need to process it a little bit more. Those passages, by the way, have always struck me as sort of deeply ironic about the argument that Christianity is inherently preoccupied with family values. Whatever that means, right? When in fact, Jesus, you know, is rather dismissive of the notion that his family is all that significant to him on several occasions. But, okay, anyway, that's neither here nor there. It reminds me of the time I heard someone give a speech about how anybody who reads the Chumash knows that marriage is between a man and a woman. And I was like, how about between a man and two women? Or four? Right? This is a strange argument. Which is not to say that there's not some argument to be made from the history of religions, but it's a strange argument to ground biblically, right? And just shows, right, it's not just progressives who read selectively. Okay. So, I don't know what the answer here is. I think that what Alana said and the way we caveated it is actually really interesting. I just wanted to make sure this kind of came to your attention, that you didn't, when you read Parashat Mishpatim, just like keep going and skip over these psukim, because I think that they are supposed to sort of shake you in the process of reading a law code. And also here, I just want to sort of make clear that the argument here is also about who is the lawgiver who gives you the law? Right? It's not just about an obligation for you to be compassionate. It's also, in both of these cases, a statement about the one who legislates is the God who is about compassion. Which I think is also kind of very important, meaning that these codes are not interested just in, oh, I am God, do what I say. That may be part of it, but it's also, oh, the God who's asking you to do what he says is a God who loves the widow and the orphan and the poor. We're not going to have time to get to this, but in the excerpt from Shaddal that we're going to just talk about at the end, he is going to say something really interesting, and I don't know whether contemporary biblical scholars agree with him, but he actually makes the claim that the pshat of the Chumash and the Halakha are, you don't need to go there now, just hear me out for a second. The pshat of the Chumash and the Halakha are not totally consonant with one another. The Halakha assumes that I have to give back the garment to someone for him to go to sleep, and then I can take it as a pledge again during the day. Right? And it's really concerned about someone being sort of cold at night, not having anything to cover him. Shaddal actually thinks that the pshat here, I'll tell you Shaddal's in a minute if you don't know what I'm talking about. Shaddal thinks that the pshat of this pasuk is, if someone is so poor, right, you're allowed to humiliate them once by taking their garment away. But then when nightfall comes, you give it back to them and you never have a claim on it again. All you can do is embarrass them one time, but you can't hold it as a pledge beyond those few hours, because after all, what is he going to wear applies not just to night, but to day. Right? Halakha is, let's say, more generous towards the lender. And his suggestion is that the Chumash is actually much more radically generous towards the borrower. Whether that's sort of historically right or not, I'm not sure. It'd be interesting to think about that. Jamie? And then
the creditor, I think you had. You can make an even stronger
better,
case.
Better word, yes.
But you can make a stronger case that the not acting as a creditor when you lend money, like the pshat of Chumash and what that ends up being in halakhic language, is sort of somewhat of an even bigger gap between who the law is tending towards, whether it's the person receiving the loan or the creditor.
Right, okay, great. Let's just push forward because I'm running out of time here. Okay, so I wanted to show you an interesting, this is sort of one of my favorite textual variants, though. Only a nerd of world historical proportions can begin a sentence saying this is one of my favorite textual variants. But in fact, this is one of my favorite textual variants. And I want to say that I've recently come across people suggesting that this might not refer to Chesed specifically, which is okay, but I think it's still a kind of an amazing little thing to think about. So this is a comment made by Abba Shaul. Abba Shaul, you may remember, is the person who last week said Ze'eliva Anvehu, right? I will become like God. And Rashi's famous comment, Anivahu, God and I will be compassionate together, right? So here Abba Shaul says, so I'm at the top of the second page of the packet, I'm reading from Midrash Sifra Kedoshim, okay? Abba Shaul Omer, Kamal Ya Lemelech, a king has a retinue. Ma'aleha Liyot, and what should the retinue be doing? Mechaka Lemelech, waiting for the king to arrive. That's what a retinue does. Now, another version. Amar Abba Shaul Omer, Pamalya Lemelech. Abba Shaul says, the king has a retinue. Uma Le'ali Yot. And what should it be doing? Mechaka Lemelech. Mechaka here with a kuf, not a kuf. Right? And chakot is to imitate. So, when waiting for the king, what does the retinue do? The retinue imitates the king's attributes. The difference, just in case the Hebrew is elusive, is between chet kafhe and chet kufhe, right? Which sound the same but are different roots. And I think there's like a lot of things you could say about these two versions, but I just wanted to say a couple of them. One is that you can read it as choices, right? There's two spiritual postures that one could adopt to a world in which God does not yet seem manifestly and fully present. You can adopt the posture of waiting, or you can adopt the posture of acting for God in the doing of loving kindness. And maybe you can say in parentheses there, thereby hastening God's arrival. I would actually prefer to say that from a religious perspective, one does both at the same time, and what it means to wait is to imitate. Right? In other words, if I walk up to Rachel and I say, "Hey, what are you doing?" She has her feet up on the coffee table and says, "I'm waiting for God." There's something theologically kind of problematic about that. Whereas, if I say, you know, "Rachel, what are you doing?" And she says, "She's feeding the poor," and she says, "I'm waiting for God," that already has theological traction. Right? The integration of working and waiting. And let's be clear about this. In other words, because I don't think, here's a thing that sort of liberal American Jews often like to say. I don't think they mean it, but they like to say it anyway. If we all sort of just were nice, we could redeem the world. I hate to say it to you, but good luck with that, right? Oh, you know, when we gather, I don't know why I'm in this kind of mood today, and I'm afraid this is being unhinged. You know, when we, actually, I'm all in favor of doing things like this, but when we gather, like, 15-year-olds, and we tell them that the essence of Torah is tikkun olam, right, a term that was secularized and became dominant in Jewish life around 1975, right? This is the heart of Torah, tikkun olam, and if we just all, you know, if we all, you know, spent our upper middle class allowances on some little thing somewhere, we could basically bring a perfected world all by ourselves. I mean, that's like startlingly naive, right? I think we might say something like, right, we have the possibility of making a contribution to bits of healing in the world. And in addition, right, I mean, the fact is we know that all kinds of things that we do in the name of some redemptive aim often have consequences we didn't expect. Right? That's the meaning of Olam Hazeh. Everything is a trade-off. And so, yeah, that makes me nervous, right? Whereas opposed to saying, no, what I'm trying to do is create moments, right, of redemption, to create little bits of redemption, because what it means to wait is to anticipate. And what it means to anticipate, right, is to enact. That's a lot better. Now, you could think that that's just sort of a fine, you know, theological distinction, but it's sort of important to me because, you know, lots of people who really took seriously the rhetoric of being human beings who could bring redemption ended up being like mass slaughterers. It's like dangerous rhetoric to me. I think it's actually interesting. I was talking recently to a friend of mine who works on an Israeli who writes on the relationship between theology and politics. And he talked about how it's very common in circles such as ours to assume that sort of political messianism refers to something that people we think of as right-wing extremists are into. And I think that that's probably fair, but it's also the case that that rhetoric pervades. I mean, read Michael Lerner's editorials about himself. No, I'm serious, right? That's political messianism if I've ever seen it. If we all just took seriously his notion of what healing consists of, there'd be peace in the Middle East tomorrow. Okay. Maybe. By the way, I want to be clear. I hope by now I have enough credibility to say this. I'm not saying this from a place of cynicism. I'm saying this from a place of wanting to have eyes wide open about what the world is like and then dive in and try to heal it, rather than convincing ourselves that, oh, you know, all we need is this and then it'll all be better. So, right, I hope that you don't just hear me as just sort of being cynically dismissive. Adaraba. So to work and to wait. And by the way, this idea appears in 20th century Jewish law. I don't actually know where it appears first. And it'd be interesting to know whether Chazal already meant this. But Rosenzweig is a really interesting example, who talks about what it means to wait for the Messiah is to enact moments of messianic presence now. And the rabbinic example that I'm thinking of is, you know, the list that appears in the Gemara. Where is this? Is it in Brach? What a person is asked when he or she dies, and the first question, if I remember correctly, the first question is Tzipita Lishua, right? Did you await, or better, did you anticipate redemption? And it's often struck me, like, what does that question mean? Does it mean that God asks you, you know, while you were watching TV, did you think, any minute now, or does it mean that you in some way created sort of foretastes in the world? I think that's sort of, I don't know, interesting, challenging, humbling at the same time, but also not delusional, which is the point I was trying to... Ross, last question, and then take a few more minutes.
I want to come in a little defense for the Tikkun Olam model of messianism. And maybe it's just like it's a subtle like wordplay distinction also. But to me, it's like what I grew up also hearing was that, like, oh, you know, I'm not going to go and like donate a quarter to Tzedakah and then like volunteer a couple hours a week. And just by us Jews doing that, or just me and my friends doing that, we're going to bring about world peace. But that there was like a really important complementary element of waiting, but then also building, and then saying that in order for this to come, this is something that we're going to sit back and wait for it to happen.
Great. So you had more sophisticated teachers than the people I taught with in various places. So if waiting was a part of it, that's totally great.
Just in the sense that, like, you can't build it overnight. Like, this is like...
Yeah, but I think Jewish theology, and here we could have a really interesting conversation that maybe we won't have right now, but can human beings ever build it alone? Is a really basic question in Jewish theology, right? In other words, does the final redemption... And it's, some people might think that this is only a question about, you know, God's prerogative versus ours, but it's also a different question, right? Does the final redemption, whatever we imagine that means, ultimately require God stepping in rather than just human beings making an effort? I think according to most traditional Jewish thinkers, right... Human beings, actually, I would say, I think, according to almost all traditional Jewish thinkers, right, human beings might be able to help make the world better, but they can't redeem it. And I don't think that that's only because, oh, that usurps God's prerogative. I think it's also a realization of how messy the world is. So it's two things. There's waiting, but then you sort of took it back a little by saying it takes time. I'm not sure all it takes is time. I mean, we've been waiting a long time for human beings to redeem the world. Right? Some people even thought, oh, modernity is here. It's going to become much easier and much faster. Mm-hmm. Right? And now look where we are.
It's sort of like you asked about the relationship that God has with the created world. And they're probably like, I think there's like Jewish philosophers from the past that also will say that God isn't having like an active hand and kind of shaping everything day in and day out. But God has already set things in motion, and now we're interacting with the motion of the universe.
Yes. Okay. So let me say two quick things, and then we'll move on, and you can help work this out, right? One is the closest version to what you're talking about is Maimonides at the end of Hilchot Melachim, where his notion of messianism appears to be 100% naturalistic. But also what that means is in many ways, not that much will change. Right? Part of his naturalism is his minimalism. You understand what I just said, right? Part of his naturalism is his minimalism, meaning if it's all going to be what we can do, not that much is really going to change. Secondly, even many thinkers who would have said, fewer of them before the modern period would have said it, but that God is not actively managing the world, still anticipated a time when God would come back and be active again. Very few of them thought, right, God will never take an active role in history again. Very few people thought that traditionally. That doesn't mean that a modern can't make such an argument, but we should be, when you're appealing to the past, it's complicated there. Maimonides might be the one person you come back to again and again, which is not a bad place to come back to, but it ain't the, like, dominant Jewish view on this question. Okay. So, I wanted to just, I mean, I guess in the interest of time, we won't do this together, but I'll just tell you what's here, okay? The rest of your packet is a series of passages from a man named Shmuel David Luzzatto, more commonly known in Jewish circles as Shaddal. And I just want to tell you a couple sentences about him and about why I had wanted to sort of end our discussion with him. Shaddal, who, as you see in the packet, lived from 1800 to 1865, was in many ways most famous for being part of the Haskalah, part of the Jewish Enlightenment movement. And he was, like a lot of the Maskilim, this sort of extreme Renaissance man, meaning he wrote commentaries on Chumash and many of the Nevi'im. He wrote commentary on medieval Hebrew poetry. He wrote modern Hebrew poetry. He wrote on the Siddur. He did philology, trying to figure out what biblical words mean. He was one of these people who just had, you know, an astonishing kind of level of learning and creativity. As a footnote to that, one of the interesting things that Shaddal struggled with his whole life was the Maskilim thought he was too religious, in traditional terms, and religious people thought he was too much of a Maskil. So he didn't really fit anywhere. He also wrote a series of, and I don't know how common this was among the Maskilim and the Wissenschaft des Judentum crowd. He also wrote a whole series of essays about what he thought Judaism was about. And one of the most important ones is called Yesodei HaTorah, which is very consciously a swipe at the Rambam, with whom he has a tremendous amount of difficulty. He writes a book called Yesodei HaTorah, and he essentially starts out by saying, you know, some people actually say things like, real human achievement is measured by the intellect, the achievements of the seichel. And then he sort of dismisses that as both elitist on the one hand and weirdly deluded on the other hand, because people can be really smart and be not the world's greatest people. And he makes the argument, which he develops through most of this book, that the core of Torah is what he calls hachemla v'hachanina, which I guess I will probably translate here as compassion and empathy. And so he'll do everything from sort of make the case to then start reading through the Chumash, trying to explain why those obvious psukim that you'll point to and say these don't seem so compassionate don't controvert his thesis. But his argument is basically that Judaism's vision of the good is chemla v'chanina, which he argues, which is why he believes it's not elitist, every human being has an innate impulse to compassion. And there's all kinds of things that get in the way, anger, rage, hurt, but there is something there. And what education for the young means on some fundamental level is protecting and growing and deepening that innate sense of compassion. He was, for those of whom this is interesting, deeply influenced by sort of theories of moral emotions from the 18th century. One of the reasons I personally find him to be such a compelling character, Shaddai was a person who suffered unbelievably in his life. His wife was sick most of their life together and then died. Two of his children died. He just had this incredibly, incredibly difficult life. And he, in the preface to this book, which I included in the packet, he dedicates it to his father-in-law. And he basically says to his father-in-law, look, you and I know that in the end, what is there but love? Right? I mean, really? Like my wife is dead and my children are dead. I'm going to talk about like how many Pesukim I know by heart. Really? And your example taught me that, so this book is for you. It's just very moving, and it's also, I don't know, I don't see a lot of like 19th century Jews talking in this deeply autobiographical kind of idiom. And it's a really interesting example of a guy who clearly appeals both to his own experience and what he discovers about life, and to his sense of what the heart of Jewish teaching is. And I think he would have been totally uninterested in the question, oh, so what was the origin of that notion? Like, that's just like not an interesting question to him. Right? I mean, it's some amalgam, like it is for all of us. By the way, just to give you a sense of how deeply committed he was to the notion that Judaism is centered around compassion, he names his, I think it's his first son, he names him Ohev Ger. That's his first name. Philo Zena, I think, is lover of the stranger. That son dies. What you have in this packet is a couple of paragraphs that I isolated where he sort of develops this idea. And I would recommend, you know, at some point during either Seder or during some other time that you look at these paragraphs. Interestingly, I don't know what the cultural meaning of this is, although it is kind of interesting. Yesodei HaTorah was out of print for a long time, and just this year came back into print as a publication of Yediot Achronot Press. It's kind of interesting. So I kind of wanted you to know about Shaddai, and also to have a sense of what this argument is all about. The last part of the packet, you know, where it says chesed and practice, is something that I put in the packet last week and we didn't get to, and I put it in the packet this week and we still didn't get to it. And it was really just that I wanted to show you this thing that has come up in Shirim and Shirim that I've given over the course of this year, like repeatedly, and has come up in private conversations a lot, and I think would be an interesting conversation for people to have with each other. I have not yet translated this. There may actually be an English translation of it, but I don't know. Sefer HaChinuch exists in English? I'm not sure. This is the place, the famous place in Sefer HaChinuch, where he argues, right, that counterintuitively, maybe for a lot of us, actions don't follow the heart, but the heart follows actions. And that the best way to change who you are inside is to act in a particular way. We've had versions of that conversation in countless contexts. And what I wanted people to... four of the words that I underlined, acharei ha'pu'ulot nimshachim halvavot, right, after the actions, the hearts are pulled, are probably four of the most famous lines written by a Jew in the Middle Ages. They're used all the time. And the discussion that I was sort of interested in, you know, having people have is... is this true? Is it wishful thinking? And also, while we're sort of at it, is there a particular mindset I have to have while doing those actions in order for them to affect me internally? Or is there something intrinsic to those actions that affects me? But as always, by the way, that is not a rhetorical question. It's actually a question I think is interesting, and I don't know the answer to it. I think you could spend a lot of time. I mean, I guess one of your options in the Chavruta time we're about to end with is to take up that question. Although if you take up that question, I just want to urge you not to take it up as a merely interesting abstract intellectual question, but a question that's about your own sense of your own experience. Right, whether it's about mitzvot ben adam l'makom, right, mitzvot between a person and God, or about mitzvot ben adam l'chaveiro, interactions, you know, between people, is it true? Is it sometimes true? Is it always true? What makes it true? That acharei ha'pulot nimshachim halvavot, that the heart is pulled by what one does. What I did is prepare a page, it's actually more, 2.5 pages, that has a series of questions. You do not have this yet. Based on the three central kind of orienting themes that we looked at, gratitude, Tzelem Elohim, and V'alachta B'drachav. The goal of the next 45, 50 minutes is not, okay, I just want to underline this, is not like to get through all the questions, right? The goal is to figure out with someone who you choose to have this conversation with, what would be an interesting place for both of you to, or all three of you, however you decide to work it out, to have a conversation. There are a couple of questions that are capable of being interpreted as merely ideational, about ideas, and I sort of want to encourage you not to sort of hide in those questions, right? From the real work of figuring out how does this stuff take root in one's life. I'm going to let you sort of figure out who you want to do this with. I will walk around, not because I feel like I'm more advanced than anybody else in these questions, but because I want to be able to help conversations if they need it. And you're also free to tell me to go away if you're in the middle of some intense conversation and I shouldn't be, you know, raining on your parade. I thought that it would be nice for me to end this series by saying something that I have said often in sort of the development of this yeshiva, which is, you know, this little midrash I constructed on the end of the Amidah on the words "Petach libi b'Torah Techa." Many of you have heard me say this before, right? "Petach libi b'Torah Techa" means literally, seemingly, right, open my heart to your Torah. But the words "Petach libi b'Torah Techa" can just as easily be, you might say, creatively misread as "use your Torah to open my heart." "Petach libi b'Torah Techa," right? Use your Torah to open my heart, and that is, in the end, I think in many ways the challenge of Torah, the promise of Torah if one lives it, and in some ways the bracha that I share with all of you, not just for this year but for your lives as people engage in Torah. So we're going to do two things right now. First, since this is the end of the series and it is also my mother's first yahrzeit, I'm going to say Kaddish Derabanan, and then I'm going to pass out these packets, and, you know, don't spend tremendous time having angst about who you want to have this conversation with. Just sort of find someone, and then we'll spend the rest of the time till 12:15 having these conversations. And if it's useful for you to share with me at some point, right, things that came up in your conversation, I would be very happy to hear them, either in person or by email or whatever feels comfortable. Okay? And thank you, Yishar Koach.
Galbi Kadash Miraba, the Almadi Barakhi Rutevi, Amlich Makute, Kayechon, Yomechon, Kayeti Kobe, Israel, Agalov, Islam Karib, Ruame, Shara, Mayor, 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 Itbarach v'ishtabach v'ishtar v'itramam v'itnase v'itadar v'italev v'italal shmei dekutshav v'rimah v'eila mikol birchata v'shirata tushmachata v'nechemata tamiran v'olma v'imroamein al Yisrael v'arabanan v'al tamidehon v'akol tamideh tamidehon v'akoman v'asdim v'oraita v'ivatra v'adein v'ivachol atar v'atar Yehi lehon lechon shlamaraba chinah v'chistav rachamim v'chayin arichin v'zanei revichei For Kanami Kadam Abahun Ishmayavim Ruamein, Yeheshlamaraba Mishmayav, the Chayim Tovim Aleinu, Alko Yisrael Vim Ruamein, Ose Shalom Vim Ramav, Ubarachamav Yase Shalom Aleinu, Alko Yisrael Vim Ruamein.
Do you want to take any pen?